Hey everybody, and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway Podcast, because I guess that you are coming back, because we've done 150 something of these things, and I'm hoping that you've caught one before. But today we have got the wonderful Ben from Curbocharge. Now, Ben is a clever dude because he's already told me all of my problems on Wi-Fi. But Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Paul, and fantastic to be on the show, having seen it for so long. So yeah, can't wait to get stuck in.
Oh, he's saying all the right things, and I'm joined by the lovely John Curtis. Well, no, we'll go with lovely. Yeah, the lovely John Curtis.
That's the nicest thing anybody has said to me all day. Now, I'm interested, Ben, you're a Whittaker. Are you any relation to Roger at all?
No. You'll have to whistle for that one. My grandfather, Whittaker, was basically ran a scrapyard in Rotherham. And from the scrapyard, he used to build inventions and useful ones. So he put together like a double-decker bus wash for the local bus company, made giant vacuum cleaners. He built the first television in his area and made the radio control systems for model planes and things, you know, always sourced from the scrapyard and making it. And, you know, always then inventiveness skips a generation because the kids don't have to fix anything in the house. And then the next generation has to fix everything. So you end up being the practical one every other generation, I think. But that's the Whittaker I'm descended from.
Wow, fascinating. Sorry, Paul, we've gone off and, you know, having a tangent moment.
I mean, but I think it is worth understanding, because Ben, you are Chief Technical Officer, I think I just said this, for Curbocharge. So for those that don't know about Curbocharge, you'll have missed all of the major press, Dragon's Den, and a number of other things in order to not know, but tell us a little bit about Curbocharge and your role within it.
Okay, well, as we know, the transition to EVs is going from the early adopter into the everybody. And having an EV is amazing. It's such a step up because while you sleep, your car's battery fills and then you start every day with a full tank and you only occasionally have to use a public charger when you do a super long journey and not even to fill the battery. You just pop in to just do a little top up to get home and then you fill it at home nice and cheaply off your solar, off your, you know, off peak. And it's brilliant. Apart from if you don't have a driveway and you live in the middle of a city or you're the 70% of fleet drivers who take their vehicle home and park, and 70% of fleet drivers don't have a driveway. And then actually the experience can be a bit tedious and 5 to 10 times more expensive. So instead of filling your tank for £3 or £4, it's 30, 40, 80 quid. And so we're figuring out, you know, how on earth do we bring all of the terraces and the people who park outside the house into the world of EV? We don't want cables trailing. We don't want bumps, which are going to trip over the, you know, limited mobility users, although jogging along at night, which I'm sure is both of you.
Oh, obviously.
So we've been, Curbocharge has worked with a whole bunch of local authorities around the country to cut a groovy groove in the pavement outside your house, which you can pop your charging cable in and charge your car in any of the three spaces nearest to your house, nice and cheaply, just like someone with a drive. And it's got a little self-closing flap that closes over it. Got one here I prepared earlier. Here's one I prepared earlier. I should have checked if I could get it on my knee. So you basically pull it open to pop the cable in, and that pops down and flat on the pavement. And that is 25 ton rated. So not only can you park a brick lorry on it or drive your cars over it, but it can also cope with a team of rugby players in high heels coming back after they've yet again won the World Cup. And cope with that, which is even harder. And so getting that through all the legislation and everything and getting the councils to agree with it and then running that as a service, which we're now joining into salary sacrifice schemes and fleet management and motability and all these other things where people need to enable EVs for their customers. We then work with them to put these in. And I love it because it's product category creation. It's putting something together that nobody's ever done before, but it's solving actually quite a big issue for the EV transition. And it's something that we're doing in the UK before everyone else. And we're then going to, you know, export around the world and make it better for everyone.
Mm. Now, Deborah Maiden from Dragon's Den absolutely loved this product, as has The Times, The Guardian, The Financial Times, Martin Lewis, you name it. Anybody who's seen this, except our very own Sam Clark, for some bizarre reason, who said it would never work, has said this is genius. Can I just probe a little? Ben, you're not an island. You work with a team of people. Michael is the chief exec. Who came up with this idea? Was it you?
No, it was Michael Goulden, the founder, who was living in London in a terrace house, got an EV because he believes EV is the best. We've got to make sure our kids are breathing cleaner air, especially in the cities. And he's like, well, this sucks. I really, really, you know, I want to find a better answer to this. So he was experimenting with what they could do to make that better, and then started working with Milton Keynes Highways team. So Milton Keynes Highways team said what the requirements are to work with real, dirty, uneven, variously maintained and cut up five ways since Sunday by the water board, the broadband and everything else. We've got to fit in this world. So off you go. Go and invent something. Mustn't be metal. Must curve so we can bend it into the pavement. Mustn't destabilize the pavements and cause us maintenance issues. Must cope with 25 tons. Mustn't have something you could forget to close or fill with dirt or all sorts of other things. And, you know, we then went off, squirreled away, and tried something, iterated to make something that could, you know, square the circle on, take a load of weight, be made of something flexible, and go in all of these different pavement styles. And that's how we've come to Curbocharge.
It's genius. And it's, it retails at around £1,000 to actually get the charging unit put in, dig out the gully, put in the flap, and get you all up and running.
Just shy of a grand if there's no subsidy. And most of that money goes to the local council. So most of that's going for permits, that's going for the pre-survey, that's going for the works to cut it all out, and a bit of that goes to us for the channel and the support and the training and everything else. Also, it's covering some of the insurance liability, and so 999 sounds like a lot of money, but for an average mileage driver, pays for itself in 9 months versus the cheapest of the public charging options if you are using a slow charger somewhere, and pays for itself in half the time if you're always using the ultra rapids at the sort of 70, 80p. So as long as you're going to live in the same house for more than half a year, then that makes sense. But good news for everybody is that the government have just put a 25 million grant out, being distributed through the councils who are fitting curbo charges, which in most cases is going to halve the cost or bring it down to zero if you're low income or notability in some cases. So get involved now, because that's reducing cost. And if you're getting a charger installed, there's now £500 off the charger install. So really isn't a better time than now to get in there. So get on curbocharge.com, put your email in, and we will email you whenever your council gets going. So you'll be there straight away to go, yes, I want that discount, and, you know, get it involved.
I mean, that is fantastic, because I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges, and I was at an event yesterday where we were talking about, you know, government money, grants, or, you know, all of the myriad of things that are going on in the background often. And there's not enough said about those things. There's not enough insight out there to make it easy for people. So we're hoping that the Curbocharge can actually make the right amount of noise. What are you guys doing to get that message out there?
Well, changing daily life is not just inventing a product. I mean, that's the Fred in the shed mentality, that I've made the better mousetrap and it will sell itself on merit. Doesn't work that way. You have to not only show people the value of the product, but then knock down all of the imagined problems that turn up. You also have to meet head on with any legislation that prevents you doing it. So at the moment, a lot of our work is not only making sure this is more visible to the EV charger installers who previously said, no driveway, no can do, and now saying, no, there is an hourway, but also to then build it into when you're getting a car through salary sacrifice, when you're getting a vehicle through commercial fleet, that this just builds into your normal purchase. We put it on Dragon's Den to make sure more people who weren't in the early adopter techie press world would find out about the idea. But then we're also doing a lot of lobbying work to make sure that not only councillors are finding out from their residents that this is a need, but also at the top of government, these are the bits of legislation which are acting like a drag on this happening. This is what makes it take so long and be so expensive to get the permits. This is what means it then you have to apply once to the county council for highways permission and then apply again to the district council for planning permission to put a charger on your house. Getting them through the Section 178 and Section 50 highways kind of approvals and then all the electrical safety. So we've got lots of different stakeholders and lots of meta problems, side things, which we then need to reassure people, work through all of the regulations and make sure that's all done, give the whole industry the playbook for how to do it, and then gradually make it boring. And everything we're doing is to try and take this exciting, wonderful thing of wow, new product, new everything. It's like, now let's make it dull. What for me as an engineer, what I love is when your invention has become so well known and understood that people don't even think of it as technology anymore. It's just kind of something that works. A previous thing that I did at one of my other startups, Masabi, was to get everybody using their telephone as a train ticket. When we originally started doing that, everybody in the industry said, your ears are going to fall off, our train stations will clog up, it'll never work. And we had to go through all of these things with the regulators and the franchises and the unions and et cetera, et cetera. And now we've made something that's so ubiquitous. It's the most popular type of train ticket in the country and nobody thinks it's clever. It's just the way things are. And that gives me that big kind of, we've changed daily life and we've made it not just to the point that people know about it, we've made it so it's now boring. And that for me as an engineer is when you've really truly, you know, achieved something and made something great is when people don't even notice it as technology anymore. And that's where Curbocharge is now going. It's turning it into that thing that you just do if you're getting an EV and you don't have a driver, you just click yes in the checkout process and somebody somewhere will squirrel off and make sure that happens for you. And it's, oh yeah, there's a thing for that. I'll just, you know, go get a Curbo. And this year, and Ozev is here today, at this is the EVI Roadshow by Cenex, the kind of final valedictory kind of event today we've been at. Ozev have been here, you know, it's the year of the gully. There's loads of work being done by Ozev to make this easier. We've got the, there's been a survey and a consultation on changing the law. So changing planning law so that if you've been given approval for the channel by the highways team, is permitted development to stick the charger on the house. Sounds small, but we have to change the law. That's going to come later this year, as well as all the grants, as well as more advice around the safety and everything else. And it's just like, these are the little things we're all as an industry getting together to make all this boring and easy. So it's just like, clicky, clicky, want the thing on this webpage and off we go and we make it work. And it's, we have clicky, the kind of, clicky, it's like
the thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the swan. The top of the swan for the consumers has to be boring, boring, boring. That looks easy. Under the surface is all the politics and the technology and the testing and the load bearing and the, you know, all the bun fights that are going on with people imagining the problems and saying, we won't do that and you couldn't do this and we've never done it like the other, and just gradually making it easy and making it boring.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europcar, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europcar's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europcar. Search Europcar Business.
And it's really interesting because I don't know if you're directly involved in the app I used today, but I've used it to going out and coming back, and I use it regularly. It's, you know, it's got a QR code on it and all of that sort of stuff. So I'm familiar with this, and it's really interesting. But what this tells me is that this is not your first rodeo, and that this has been like a journey for you. We talked a little bit about your grandfather and you know, his inventions. And at what point did you know that inventions and this kind of innovation was your world? How did you kind of come about that?
Well, I've always been a tinkerer. As a child, I would take apart every toy. My parents thought, wonderful, we've got a vandal. But having been patient and let me take apart that many toys to find out how they work, eventually I started putting them back together again. And that's when you know you've got an engineer, not a vandal. And so gradually I'd like be tinkering. And, you know, computers were coming out. And some of the kids, you know, their parents got a computer, especially like a business computer or something. And I said to my dad, you know, computers, I think they might be a big thing in the future. I might look young, but I'm not young. And I said, can you, you know, get a computer? And he said, okay. And he went to his office and then brought back a cardboard box of components. And he said, yeah, the IT guy says this was a computer once. And so I'd never used a computer. So I tried to put it together and it didn't power up. So I took apart the power supply and find out what had burnt out. And I go dumpster diving. So jumped in a skip. Back then you would always find VCRs and broken televisions. Took all the circuit boards from that, smashed them apart, got a few of the components, soldered them together to bridge across the burnt out bits of the board, got it to power up, found that keyboard chip had gone, found another one of those, found the whole thing didn't even have a graphics card. So I saved up and I went out and bought a secondhand graphics card for 12 quid as a punt. And then I got it to boot. Well, not even boot. I got it to, you know, turn on, and it's like, oh, needs an operating system. What's an operating system? Let's find out about that. And so built the whole thing up from scratch and then started doing computer repair to help other people, having learned that, and always been a tinkerer. At university, I started a business to get rid of wing mirrors on cars. We did a bit of a kind of joint venture with Jaguar Cars. Didn't quite make that business work. So that one sank into the swamp. And we gave half of the money back to the investors, which surprised them. They didn't normally get that when things tank. I got involved in helping other people to start businesses and did a business plan competition, which me and some other people created at uni. Then at the end of the uni, some other friends wanted to start a business and I helped them. And we didn't know what the idea was. We wanted to scale. We just did consultancy work to have a look inside other people's industries and try and find something to build. And we did a whole bunch of things unfashionably too early. So as I said earlier, you know, just like in comedy and romance, business, timing is everything. So we did the first viral game, the first freemium games. We did the first international money transfer from phones and mobile banking. We did the first Internet of Things kind of remote monitoring for refrigeration and air conditioning. This was all in kind of the year 2000, 2001, pre-iPhone. All of these things are now high street, normal, everyday things. But before the iPhone, we were doing this on Nokia candy bars and things like that. And it was just too early. So even when we made everything work, there were only about 12 people who could be bothered to do it. So we would use all our money that we made from doing databases and websites to experiment. So we would, you know, half the money we made, we just put into experiments, which we did for free. So we did like mobile parking payments and mobile train tickets. And we did it all at our own cost. And we said to train companies, you don't have to believe in this and invest in it. We'll pay for the whole thing to start with. And if people like it, then you'll pay us. And that's how we started to get to it. And just as we were doing that, the iPhone came out. And for a change, we weren't that unfashionably early. And so that's what got us into that. Having grown that to be a global business, it does a few billion dollars worth of tickets a year in New York and Los Angeles and everywhere from Australia to Alaska. It's a great British export. I think it's 380 people. It's made, I think, a few thousand person years of high tech employment, which I love. And it's a sort of real passion business for everyone to do active transport and public transport around the world. So I kind of stepped back a bit from that. I was going out to try and find other things to do and started working, supporting Michael in Curbocharge. And just like, yes, this is what I want to do. This is one of those funny little problems that the world needs to solve to make electrification work. And I think we've got something really quite special to solve it now in a relatively elegant way and take all of that business to government experience I had getting the railway tickets through the kind of barriers of disbelief from the industry that this could ever work. And then working on the longer timescales of government and regulator to get all of those side problems solved. And that experience really helps with Curbocharge, which really, it's not a getting to consumers and consumers to understand that's an important thing, but we need to get everything to work with the public sector first and foremost. And so it's that public sector language and an understanding that really helps us have the impact and kind of making this possible that's made it move as fast as it has, really, I think.
Ben, there are a couple of other things that make what you do very, very special. You mentioned passion, and I'm interested to understand where your personal passion comes from, because it comes across in every word you say. And the other thing is communication. You are an incredibly clear communicator, and I'm interested to understand how you have been shaped by life to be that passionate, resilient human being who's just excellent at being able to describe the things, the madness that goes on in your head, and turn it into something genius.
Oh, well, thank you for that. That's a compliment and a half. I'd say the most important thing, if you're going to be in startup business and want to inspire an early team to work with you and then get people to invest in the empty box that you haven't filled with the product yet, I'd say you should study at school or out of school or at university drama. If you've done drama and you know about storytelling and you know about holding a room and you know about, you know, finding the rise and the thing to get into and the bits you've got to bury and edit out, if you've got that running in your head the whole time, that can help you to tell the story of something new and try and think ahead of it. I think that drama school. Not drama school, just even, you know, Amdram just can sometimes be really, really helpful in this space. And I loved it. It made me come alive from a child that was bullied into someone who then had a space and did more. And that really helped.
And that's interesting because, Paul, National Youth Theatre was your proving ground. Do you subscribe to Ben's view?
Well, I mean, not being an entrepreneur in the same way that Ben is, for sure. I think that I get quite nervous still when I stand up in front of people. So I learned techniques during that time. Not all of the time, but if I'm presenting, I'm the central focus, and I'm going to speak for 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and I'm at the front and you're sitting there waiting, I'm doing things like anchoring. So, you know, I'm anchoring my feelings. I'm breathing more deeply. I'm, you know, considering what I'm going to say for the first line or first couple of lines. And so you're going. And I learned, I can't repeat the way that my director taught me to articulate oneself, but because he said that you should do something. Anyway, we won't go into it, but because it's definitely not for this. But you have to believe in yourself, and you have to have that centeredness, that presence that is sort of convey. You know, you're projecting, aren't you? I think that's the phrase. But yeah, I think it's really interesting because drama. So for me, I was a bit of an outcast. I'm not saying you were. But you talked about that process of being bullied. I was a little bit bullied. I was in a children's home in care, and drama was the thing that got me. I felt in control of myself because I could kind of be somebody else. Is what was the process for you? And I know we're getting quite personal there, but you know, how was that journey for you?
Well, I think it was. I've always been a geek. I've always, you know, read encyclopedias, got into physics, got into tinkering with things, and anything I'm really interested to, it's kind of figure it all out from first principles. And the people I hung out with were, you know, good at maths, good at technical things. And we were the funny little group. But what we also did is we were very welcoming to everyone. And so gradually, the funny little group of geeks, because we welcomed all groups, we actually became bigger than the group of cool kids who, you know, sneery and, you know, love to be a critic. And one of the great quotes was from, I think, Roald Dahl to his children. And he said to his kids, whatever you're into, whatever funny little niche or little thing that you, your hobby or whatever, if you're into it, grab it with both hands. Don't hold back and try and be polite about it. The world needs enthusiasts. Do not be embarrassed and shy. And everything we did by having a gradually increasing group of misfits, geeks and other things is like, well, in our group, then it's great to be into stuff and organize little trips and get everybody into stuff. And, you know, that was great. And it wasn't cynical. It was, you know, celebrate those things. And that kind of freedom to celebrate the things that your niche is, et cetera, I think that comes into creating safe spaces for companies who are going to try something new. Being in a company where you meet experts who say, this rule, that rule says you can't do this and we've never done it. And you say, well, that's very useful. Let's change it. Because you get that bravery that being the misfit or trying a new thing and putting the enthusiasm in is okay. You don't have to always be withdrawn and a bit shy because you might fail. And that can really help. And I think in drama school and in drama situations, the freedom to try it and fail is there. And I think that can really help. But you need good friends and other people around who give you that support. And you know, I think that helps.
It's fantastic. I love this bit, John, where we unwrap the bits that people have to go through to be the people that they are. And it's really exciting. At what point did you know that you had that little something special? Was it when you started trying to, you know, break out in university, those that competition that you created and those things that you did?
Well, I think at school, we were already creating our own kind of activities and things. And then I turned down a place at university to go for a year out because I wanted to figure out why. I didn't just want to go from one conveyor belt of education and institution to another conveyor belt and another. I wanted to figure out why, you know, how does that fit into the workplace? So I went off to do a year in industry, turned down university, and the year in industry was fantastic. Whole bunch of, you know, kids out of A-level, all given expense accounts and access to hire cars and get to live on our own and figure out how on earth to run a tumble dryer. And we all did this really weird IBM year out. And the guy who was running the IBM year out, a guy called Ian Nussey, was a kind of luminary from IBM. And he could have run anything in his dotage years. And he's like, what I want to do is this little year out thing. And instead of hiring a bunch of people who clearly were like a normal intake for IBM, a bunch of really good, you know, worker bees, he deliberately sought out the weird ones, the quite odd misfits, the ones who are a little bit arty, the ones who are a bit unmanageable, the ones who are weird. And he's like, yeah, only about 5% of these people are ever going to come and work at IBM, but one or two of them might come in and save it or be the CEO or something else. And I went to a really good university, loads of engineers, loads of scientists, and a few of them started to make startups. Out of this little gang who went to IBM, I think about 70% are now running global startups because they were all in this huge IBM thing and none of us followed the rules. You know, you'd set us off and say, right, I need you to do that. And we'd all like a distracted something, just go, there's a problem over there. I'm going to go do that problem. And we'd make little kind of groups and secretly have a skunk works to kind of save a couple of million quid by joining a mainframe to a bunch of client server things and make a little website. And it's like, my manager hated me. He said he never does anything. And there were 10 other managers that I actually been doing work for together with other people who were like, this is amazing. And it's like none of us would sit still. We were all just like, you know, slightly bending the rules here and creating a new solution there. And, you know, all of us then just went off and went to university and started businesses there. And a whole bunch of them didn't even go to university. They just said, no, I'm going off to make companies and do other things. And it was that kind of experimenting. So at university, getting the university to give me a little room to run my first startup, that was really useful. failing was really useful, and learning how not to fail. I mean, I, you know, my first business failure, when you invest yourself in a startup, the startup becomes you and you are the startup. And if it fails, it means you're a failure, and you can burn friendships, relationships, health. There's the old story that you've got, I think it's family, friends, and health and business. Pick any two. And yeah, it ruined me following it down too far and not saying, you know, this isn't going to work and pull out of it. And it, to have had a really bad failure is a really good teacher to help you to make changes earlier when a business is going wrong, rather than trying to be a pleaser and not to change people's happy day if it's only going wrong slowly. So I'd say failing was a really, really good teacher. When we were doing the business plan competition, the best thing is not somebody with a book of 10 steps to be successful. It's when we got in entrepreneurs who told us their disaster stories. This is how it went wrong. That's how I got sued. I ran out of money here. I totally invested wrong there. Everybody remembers that. And those are the best stories. And if you ever get to spend time with an entrepreneur, don't ask what makes them successful. Find out about the disasters, all of those lessons you can learn without having to actually be the crash test dummy yourself. That can really help. And yeah, failure. It, you know, the lessons are free, but mandatory.
Stop. I'm really frustrated at the moment because I desperately want to ask you how you recover from the failures, but I've actually got a great question in my head, which is a bit positive, and I want to go with the positive because that's who you are now. So, you know how comedians keep a notebook, and when they see a humorous situation, they write it down and they keep maybe years of observations in a notebook because they'll put it in their routine one day? As a problem solver, do you have a similar approach where you go around and you look for problems that you can fix? Or do you just get to the end of a business startup and sell off and then you go, right, what am I going to do now? And you just find the next problem. What's your process?
Well, I think it's a bit like, what is luck and are you a lucky person? And it's one of those, if you want to be in the right place at the right time, you make sure you're in lots of places at lots of times, and that makes you lucky. So I had rolled out of one business, you know, that's going off. It's got a fantastic team running that. And I was deliberately going to the Fully Charged show, hanging out with some other people who had done startups and other things. And we're all like, there's so much is going to change in the electrification and the renewable space. That's the space that excites me. I want to find a problem here that we can put our hearts into and make something impactful. So deliberately going, like with a notebook, let's have a look at what is being sold here. What problems are being solved well? Where are the gaps in these things? And trying to have a look around there. Also, I always just teach. Everywhere I'm always doing little lectures. I was the Royal Society dropped me into UCL to kind of try and help startups there, and I just give free advice to fancy dinners are great. I was helping people, like friends would just say, oh, you should go talk to Ben, find out his story, and I'd just basically give a whole bunch of free advice, and then occasionally people would go, well, can I get you in a bit more? And so I was sort of chatting to Michael, and he was showing me what he was building. And I was like, oh, I'd change the injection molding there and maybe this, and how are you doing? And he's like, you know, do you want to come in and do this? He's like, yes, this is fantastic. And I've been deliberately trying to find a problem here. And so I got into Curbocharge by doing stuff for free, by deliberately being available, by deliberately going out and trying to find something in the space. It's like, I know I want to do this space. And you don't always have to be the idea person. Startups are made by an idea person and a whole bunch of other people who help then turn it into something that can actually deliver value into the world. So Michael is the concept developer, and he's like, ah, I've worked in business to government. I can help you with that. I've worked in engineering and manufacturing. I can, you know, get into that. And it's like, wearing a hard hat and armored boots and cutting into the pavement. Yeah. Yeah, I can do that. And so, you know, the fact that I've, you know, worked in steelworks and fighter aircraft and all sorts of other things means I've got a relatively wide experience sort of as an engineer. And when you're working with other engineers, they can smell They can smell someone who's a bit too ivory tower and academic, and they know someone who, when they pick up a big power tool, is knows what they're doing with it. And that really helps as well when you can turn yourself to that, but not be too constrained by the way it's always been done. It's like, here's how we're going to do that. And yeah, great fun.
It's
great
brilliant. Fun. It's interesting. There's a parallel here with the EV Cafe in that we have a founder, Johnny Berry, who had this idea 6 years ago during COVID to have this community that came together to just make sure everybody was okay and that we were able to continue to talk and share whilst we were all locked down. He couldn't deliver what we all deliver collectively, and we all brought different aspects of skills, if you like, to the table. And somehow it just works. And it's a wonderful feeling when you get to the right place with the right people, with the right mission to go and do exactly something you truly believe in. And I see that reflected in you so, so much. You don't want to come and work with us, do you, Buddy Jones?
Oh, if I get to chat to lots of people all the time, maybe so. But the way you've described it is how you build a company, because you start wearing all the hats and many of them don't suit you. And some of the jobs are the bits you love and you're very good at. And some of the jobs are literally your kryptonite. It's a poison to you. And even though it would have taken a good person at that 5 minutes to do it, it takes an enormous amount of emotional energy for you to play outside of your expert area. And so the job is, as the business gradually finds its feet, is to find people who are better than you and different to you and give them the hats. And sometimes somebody will arrive in the business and you'll go, well, here's two hats for you. And in fact, I quite like that hat, but you're better than me at that. And it's like, here's the hat. And your main job is to make yourself redundant, is to find the people who cover all of your blind spots and who are as different to you as possible to make sure you don't stuff up, because that's in your area that you're really bad at. And, you know, I've got a whole bunch of areas I'm appalling at. And weirdly, me and Michael are almost mirrored in some of those things. And he despairs at the, you know, some of my completer finisher and paperwork and bureaucracy, which is, that's my kryptonite. And it's like, I need people who are the opposite, and you have to kind of hire them, give them the hats, encourage them. And it's exactly as you were saying, you know, EV Cafe needed a whole bunch of slightly different personalities to come behind the initial idea. That makes it something that's self-sustaining, and it's going to run itself out of the energy and the rightness of the feel of the, you know, the completed product by having those different elements and personalities. And
oh, he's fab. He's fab, isn't he? I love him.
It is. And so, John, I'm kind of ruminating, because we've got a partner day coming up.
I was having that exact you guys, thought.
Well, I think you guys will have been invited courtesy of one of your key customers. I don't know if we're allowed to say your key customer. Are we allowed to, from your point of view? I believe so. So Openreach is a massive customer of yours, and you're solving that 70% problem for them, because it's a massive thing. And when you're at that scale, it's a huge, huge cost, not least the productivity that you save, because you're allowing them to start each day with a full tank, as you say, rather than be out there charging on a rapid charger, which, I mean, we say only, might only cost £60 or £70 to fill up, but it's actually stopped them from working, which has doubled or trebled that cost. So
you're anyway, exactly so right. One of the big energy companies, they said for their fleet, if they gave an electric van to an engineer who couldn't charge at home, it was costing them £500 a month in lost productivity. So if you then add any of the energy savings, you're paid off putting a channel in just over a month. So even if you have an employee that leaves very rapidly afterwards, which, you know, there sometimes is an early dropout rate, it's paid for itself in a month and a half. So it's very easy to make that work. So for them, this, I think the head of the program stood up at a recent kind of all like big company thing and said, cross payment is the most important thing to our fleet electrification strategy, because we've very rapidly done all the low hanging fruit and the people who are easy who've got driveways. And that is a minority of our drivers. Without this, we can't go there and it's a pig. There's only so many times that you've got paperwork to do and videos to do just at the time you want to do some charging. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense unless you can get the bulk of your engineers charging while they sleep.
Absolutely. And that is the fundamental thing. So anyway, so what I was thinking was it's too short notice for Monday, which is, it doesn't matter. It's in the past now, everybody. Kind of like my internet in the past. Anyway, we won't go there. But maybe for our next partner day, I'm kind of feeling, and Ben, I'm going to invite you right now. Do you want to be a keynote speaker on entrepreneurialism, problem solving, right? That's it, booked. So it's going to be around in September, early October. So
sign me up. You're
our next guy.
Yeah, pump it into my veins. I am all over that.
Yeah, I'm loving this. And I'm confident because there's a bit of drama in there. So you'll be pontificating. A bit of Richard III. One of my lines for a Shakespeare workshop was, tennis balls, my liege. And I think it was actually Richard II, but that was my only line. So I wasn't very good. But anyway, that's okay. We don't mind. But I know we're sort of pressing on with time, but you mentioned about, and I'm always for the, like, kind of finding out what happened and what went wrong, because you talked about those failures and what the lessons that you learned. Can you paint us a picture? Because you'd be forgiven for thinking that everything has been really good. You have mentioned failure, but you've mentioned failure as almost like a throwaway thing. You know, I failed, but, you know, it's, and I get that your positive spirit has brought you on, but there must have been days when it was pretty dark and the failing really kind of got on top of you. So I'd love to know what that was, but also how you came through it.
Well, I think basically often one of the issues is that you take everything on your shoulders. You feel that every investor has trusted and, you know, put money in. You've got employees who've worked late nights, who've really, really, you know, invested themselves in it, and they're expecting their salaries and their ongoing employment. And when you get to the point where you're having to make layoffs, you're going to have to downsize or shut a business, it's absolutely heartbreaking. You feel not only that you are a failure to yourself, you feel that you're failing all these other people, and you can go into a very dark place. And so my first business failure, I probably was very depressed and very negative about myself for quite a while after that, and didn't know, you know, what I was going to do. I thought, you know, I am a failure. You know, my hubris of thinking that I could do that was so wrong, and I am so wrong. And it's like, oh. And you kick yourself, and you know, in some cases, keep trying to make it work long after you should have walked away. And the real hard lessons are how much it hurts you and those you love to stay too long when it really, you should have changed everything at the minimum or turned it off at an earlier point. I'd say you sometimes become very, as an entrepreneur, you have to be able to carry on doing something when everybody tells you, you know, it's a stupid idea, but you have to eventually let some feedback in. And it's tricky to choose which feedback to come in when everybody tells you no from the very beginning, and it's table stakes that you plow on anyway. It can be really tough. And I'd say, timing, market timing can be that you're just spinning your wheels and there's not enough demand. My first business is I didn't spend enough time lobbying within customers we'd already landed to get them to move something up from pilot to further. I've also had situations where you've won top management, you've won the customers, but you forget to bring middle management in, and then that, you know, buries the whole thing. And very much learned that, you know, if you try to make it your success and for your glory, then that can be very hard. If you can find a way to make it the win for other people, and that they think it's their idea and that their career is projected forward and they look great and get the press release and have the plaudits, you've already won. And they go off and they look amazing and you just sit back quietly. you know, you don't spend your whole time on podcasts saying, oh, I've done amazing things. You know, it's great that you've given me an opportunity to say that. But most of the time, I'm quietly solving the problems and letting other people have the press releases and everything else and making it their career goal. And then everyone else pulls up the idea. And so my failures taught me you've got to make it everyone else's win. And that was really, really useful. And it's like occasionally you do have to do the big show and get everyone excited. And that's very fun in some contexts. But most of the time, you're solving things to make other people successful and, you know, pulling it back a bit quite a lot when you're not having, you know, a fun conversation like this.
Well, listen, I appreciate you going there because, you know, to reflect back on those tough times can be quite the challenge sometimes. But I'm really grateful that you did. But also that we've got to hear some of those lessons that have come out. It's very cool, isn't it, John?
Oh, it's just brilliant. I've got one final question, Ben, and it's about, you mentioned, or somebody mentioned that it's not your first rodeo. I think it was Paul mentioned it earlier. I suspect that Curbocharge isn't your last rodeo either. What's the next horse that you're going to ride? What's the problem you're going to solve?
Well, just like you were saying with the book of joke ideas, I've got a few very fun, silly things, which are just lifestyle companies, just for giggles. If a time comes when I'm sort of, you know, Curbocharge has got a bigger team and going further, I'm looking for something else, then that will be one of the kind of palate cleanser kind of products and companies I'll do.
Sorbet.
I'll show you all when it gets there, and I will invite you there in your Speedos, and you will have the most giggles you've ever had. So that's coming.
You may end up with stomach problems if I turn up with my Speedos.
Exactly, that's it. I was thinking that.
I don't really know what the next serious business is going to be, and it's going to be a while before we get there. But it's. I think the main thing with it not being your first rodeo, that the main thing that really helps a business is go and is having the confidence that you can cope with the problems. It's not that you've got all the answers. It's not that you've thought about everything and everything is planned and you know it in advance. And it's not that we can pre-plan any of that because so much of it is new. You're just building a team where people can look to you because it's not your first rodeo and go, oh my God, somebody's suing us. Oh my God, there's a new entrant. Oh my God, there's a money problem. Oh my God, there's, you know, whatever it is the thing. And it's not that you've got an instant answer, but you're drawing on experience of, oh yeah, I've seen this before. This is what we'll do. Or, oh, I know who we're going to ask about this. And the best phrase, and whenever some of the other entrepreneurs I'm supporting are having a big issue, they ring me on the phone and it's like, it's a calm voice. It's like, it's probably not as bad as it sounds. And it's a quote from Churchill, I think, which is, you've got to meet success and defeat and treat those two imposters the same. And so you're having an amazing week, a whole bunch of big new announcements have come in and partners have come in and an investor was really happy. And it's like, yeah, but it's not all done. You've got more stuff. So you've got to keep doing the right thing and, you know, celebrating the things that are good, but know that you've got to still do the thing. And then a terrible week happens and a whole bunch of problems happen and everything else. And you go, actually, it's more of the same. And you've got to stack rank the important things to do. What have you got control over? Let's pull those levers. What have I not got control over? I've just got to accept that. That's just the way the world is, and concentrate on pulling the levers that I have control over. And that's the not your first rodeo bit that most helps everybody around you, not only in our partners, in our employees, and in some of the clients we work with, is that they've got someone who's not going to panic when something doesn't quite go the way you want it. It's like, yeah, but our job is to deal with those uncertainties and problems when they come in. And that's why the multiple rodeos gets easier, because you build up the toolbox of not panic.
Very good. Now, Ben, we have a closing tradition. And I'm not sure that I've ever conducted said closing tradition so pointlessly, because I don't think that... and it'll all become clear, but I'm just not I'm not sure that you need this to achieve anything, but nonetheless, we're going to offer it. John, you understand, don't you?
I totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Our closing tradition is to present you with the EV Cafe magic wand. There we go. I mean, you got Ben. You know all of this because you've listened to so many. Oh, he's grabbing it all quick. He's had it already. Oh my gosh. Well, you know, I thought it was pointless, but no, it's clear that. Oh my gosh, look at that. That's a big one. Anyway, so we've handed you the magic wand, the EV Cafe magic wand, and you have one wish. Now, you know, I'm not sure that you need magic to make your wishes happen, because you do seem to be one of those people that makes things happen. But what would you like to make happen easier than it would be in the real world?
Ooh. I would say, previously I would have said I want to change the law for planning permission, but I think that's going to come to pass. So the next thing is probably the things are proceeding acceptably. I'd say the other one is public charge point operators have now been given simplified roadworks permitting access so that they don't have to go through all the rigmarole. They can just log in on Street Manager and say, I'm opening the road here to do this, that, and the other. The council have already given me approval to do these sites, so I'm just going to log that in and out. And that's just been changed in law, and we just want them to just say public charge point operators and cross pavement, and then a whole bunch of stuff gets easier. And that is, I've told someone else today, that's my magic wand wish. I'll carry on saying that. But the nice thing is you just keep working with people, keep making a good case for it and making it a win for lots of other stakeholders. And enough of this will come to pass to make it smooth enough. But that, I think, would be my very, very technical in the weeds wish.
Hey, listen, but do you know what? Sometimes it's just a little, you know, when, not that I've ever picked a lock, well, not successfully anyway, but you kind of fiddle around and it's just kind of the little tweak that unlocks the door. Yes, exactly that. For those of you that are not watching, Michael sort of leaned forward and opened the floodgates. That was it. But Michael...
Take the sand out of the gears and then everything starts to work. And I think the other thing they say with businesses is you tune the engine before you pour in the nitrous. And it's like, get those little bits of sand out of the gears and then everything's ready to really rock and roll.
Ben, it's been fantastic talking to you. I mean, genuinely. And so I've been quite close to Openreach for the last little while. We came and saw you in December when we were at Birmingham. So we're going to the same place on Monday. And hopefully you're coming. I don't know if anybody from Curbo Charge is coming. Will you be there?
I think we've got several people will be there. I don't know if I'm on the docket for the day because we're very, very stacked back to back. Because, well, as you might know, thanks to the government... grant that's come out for cross pavement, we've gone from the early adopter councils. I think we've got 50 councils we're signed up with, 50 tier one kind of county councils. And when the grant came out, OZEV pulled a blinder. They basically said it's very easy to apply for. The main thing is you've got to commit that you will use this money to roll out cross pavement. So we've gone from a minority of councils to over 80% of councils have all signed up to get going with cross pavement. So essentially now we've suddenly got a whole bunch all stacked up that need their install teams training, they need their paperwork all helping. So we're basically going all around the country helping to make sure the installation teams are right, having meetings, getting this in, working with Motability to get our new accessibility tool in for a load of their recipients who are all going EV. Motability are fantastic on renewables and EV. And so we're absolutely chocker. So we have to kind of turn up and shift. So I don't know if I will be there on Monday, but I'm sure Michael and maybe Mark will be there with you to enjoy the event. And I'd love to come in September. And yeah, we'll do a dance.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you what, my street credibility has gone right up, because now when I go on the London Tube, which we're doing next week, Paul, we're going on the trains and all that kind of stuff, I will get out my digital ticket and I can honestly say I know the guy who invented that, and I'm going to bore thousands and thousands of people with the knowledge that I've made a new friend. Ben Whittaker, you are bloody outstanding, my friend. And genuinely, it has been a joy to meet you virtually. And I cannot wait. Now, tell me, are you a hugger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time.
Excellent. Excellent.
He's so, in drama, darling.
Oh, of course. In September, you and I, we're having a hug.
Bring it on.
Good man.
Ben, I'm loving the fact that we've had you on. I think so many people will be truly inspired, genuinely, to give it a go, to learn from their mistakes, because here we have somebody that, you know, you've articulated that you've had your challenges, but you've also articulated so well that, you know, a little bit of tinkering can lead to something quite amazing, and you know, you're living proof of that, and thank you for spending the time with us on obviously what is a busy day, I've no doubt,
no, it's been great fun, and thank you so much for coming on and you know, literally treating me to talking about myself for the whole hour. It's just a joy. Very rare. It doesn't happen all the time, but it is really fun when you get to do a look back and actually go, oh yeah, bits of that were quite good.
Understatement of the century.
And on that note, everybody, it has been a real joy, as we've said, to have Ben Whittaker, the CTO of Curbocharge. And we can see why Curbocharge has been so successful, because with people like Ben in the chair that he's been in, it's been quite fantastic. So, Ben, I'm sure you don't mind me inviting people to connect with you on LinkedIn and things like that. Is that okay? We'll
absolutely.
Definitely check out Curbocharge, follow them on LinkedIn as well. And if you are living in a terraced house, you can have charging right outside your door. And that would be a fantastic thing and save you a lot of money very, very quickly if you are currently driving an EV or want to drive one in the future. So, in the meantime, go and listen to many of the other podcasts, because they have all got wonderful insight from wonderful people and some great stories in amongst there, and just share them with your friends and pass this one on to somebody else, because you know, we need to get beyond the usual suspects. We need other people, and this is a great story to help people that don't currently have an EV to have one, especially with people like Ben behind the wheel, as it were. So until next time, everybody, have a wonderful day, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.